don't treat fraud as cost of doing business. It doesn't have to be. Make sure that what you're doing is adapted to your domain and don't try to build rules. You have to use, it's a machine learning game. There's no point in trying to do anything else. No point.
The most common cause of bad customer experience isn't that high tech. It's embarrassingly simple. Yep, it's answering questions. In e-commerce, it's really easy to get bogged down with common questions, whether that's where's my package, how do I return or exchange this item, or just to cancel a subscription. SolvePath is an AI-driven customer support system that enhances the customer experience with visual formats and self-serve technology to empower your customers to handle their own support requests. Get the best customer support system for your business. Get SolvePath. Get started by visiting getsolvepath.com. Welcome to FinTech Confidential, bringing you the people, tech, and companies that change how you pay and get paid. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Ted. Very happy to be here.
Insure.ai, which is an Israeli fraud prevention platform that helps sellers of digital goods protect themselves against fraud. Now, it uses machine learning models to analyze real-time data to provide revenue assurance and chargeback guarantees. It seems to be reducing declines by about 70% compared to the industry average, allowing retailers to recover almost $100 billion of potentially lost revenue from the declines from legitimate customers in some of the higher risk domains. Alex, you are the CEO and co-founder of Insure.ai, and you've held a bunch of executive positions at multiple, and you founded multiple companies as well. You've been a partner at AfterDocs and then the COO and GM at Zeek, which was a European gift card marketplace. And then before that, you spent some time as the CEO of Artizone, which was really cool. I really like that farmer's market thing that you had done there. Then you were the GM of Smart Team. Then you also spent a bunch of time at Dassault. It just keeps going. You've done everything from sales, marketing, product development, customer success, finance. And the one that surprised me really was you touched into the HR world. So I've got to understand, how did all of these different pieces and parts and all these roles that you played, how did you end up falling into fintech?
Wow. That's a good question. I haven't thought about that one. The answer is very simple, right? So I've been GM for a company called Zeek. It was a gift card marketplace. We were doing about 100 million a year in sales of digital gift cards, and which is already a fintech business. It's important to understand that, because selling digital gift cards online is very similar to selling cash. Very similar, especially if you're dealing with gift cards from Amazon, from Walmart, from Tesco, from these type of organizations. What really brought me in there is that the first week we launched our product in the UK, we encountered massive amounts of fraud. We didn't expect that, right? We started the company and launched it in Israel. The Israeli market is very small from a consumer perspective. So we stopped it. We launched it in the UK the first week. It was very nice, right? We ran out of inventory. We were very happy. And then the week later, we found out that 40% of the sales we've accomplished were fraudulent. And we started getting their chargebacks. And eventually, on something that we make 3%, 4% as a margin, we found ourselves hit with 40% of fraud. It's devastating for a company. It was a good thing, by the way, that we ran out of inventory. We bought the inventory and sold it rather than being connected on an API. If we were connected on an API, it would have been a disaster. Could have killed the company.
How did you end up at Zeek? Yeah. How did you go from like Dassault to a farmer's market over to the gift card market? I'm kind of baffled. How did that transition happen?
Artizone was an online farmer's market. It has nothing to do with fintech, right? And almost has no fraud. Nothing happened there. But the reality of it is very simple. The company before that, I was I was at a small startup called CellGlide. I was brought on board to run engineering, and I had an employee there who was a developer at the time, a guy named Ziv. And Ziv continued on his own path. I continued on my own. We kept on in touch. I lived in the U.S. for a few years with Artisan, and we sold the company there, and I came back to Israel with a family. And he asked me to come, you know, get some coffee together with him. I remember that I landed on August 15th, and I intended to take a year off, right? Because it was, you know, it's a lot, right? We had Artisan for 7 years. You know, a journey of 7 years with a startup is like 7 dog years, right? It's like 50 years.
Exactly.
So it's difficult. And I said, I'll take a year off. And so he met me for coffee. I told him, I'm not gonna do anything. I'm gonna go to the beach. He said, No. Look, we've just raised funds. We need to scale. We have no idea how to do that. We have no idea. And they raised, at the time they raised $10 million. And he asked me to come on board, and I actually said, okay, I'm willing to come on board for 3 months as a project. I'll help you. You know, I'll take the reins. I'll do what needs to happen. And it was funny. When I joined, so I on September 1st, I was there like full time. That's
it. Oh my goodness.
And we took the company from, we were doing in September, in August, we were doing about $350,000, $400,000 in sales, right, in turnaround for the company. In December, we were doing 3 million.
Oh.
And in December after that, we were doing 11 million.
Wow. Nice growth.
A very nice growth. So, you know, after the first 4 months, the founders and the board asked that I stay on the company and run the business. And I said, okay. I didn't intend to, but I said, okay. It was a very fun ride. So, you know, going from 300, 400K in turnaround a month to 11 million within, you know, less than 18 months is a very interesting journey, a very interesting journey. And that's where we encountered fraud, as I mentioned. And that's what brought me to fintech.
Did you negotiate in there that you could, your office was going to be from one of the picnic tables down there on the beach? Yeah.
Of course. Of course. Yeah.
Oh,
I negotiated, so, you know, a 9-to-5, right? I'm 9-to-5. I'm a 9-to-5 guy.
Oh, so through that journey of coming into fintech, having that massive growth, finding out about the fraud, then turning around and developing and building out insure.ai, from then to now, what is the one thing you've learned that sticks in your mind the most about the fintech journey you've been on?
I'm a very detailed oriented person in general, right? I can see the big picture, but I need the details. I don't feel comfortable when I can't dive in, understand something, and then come back out to see the bigger picture. And fintech is very, very, very detail oriented, right? At the end of the day, it's understanding the details of how, you know, how funds flow, mm-hmm. what happens from one stage to the other. It's very complicated, right? It's very risky. It's very complicated. It's very costly to make mistakes, right? Because you're touching funds. It's not like you had a mistake and, you know, there's a button now that doesn't work on some website. It's not that button now is the one that is used to pay for something, right? And if mm-hmm. that doesn't work, it's a nightmare. So what I found that's very interesting in fintech is, you have to understand the details. You have to understand the business implications of everything you do. And you cannot do that well enough. You have to figure out exactly what makes the business tick, what can create that margin you need that can scale through time. And that's what I'm finding here at Insure as well. It's very, very interesting to figure out where the value really lies. What are the clients willing to pay for? What do they get?
You mentioned fintech and the details and needing to be able to understand all the details. What role do outside perspectives are you leveraging in order to get into those details of things that maybe you or even your customers don't even know about?
It's important to be humble on that aspect. Don't Don't assume you know everything because you don't. Even if you're, if you dug in and you feel like you understand everything, you can, believe me, there's someone that understands more. So there's more to uncover. And we've been using services and external advisors throughout the journey for Insure. We hired, you know, a couple of people that have expertise, that really understand the domain, that have done that at, you know, at different really large companies. I won't name names. And then you get the insights from people that have seen the bigger picture, understand the details, understand what you're trying to achieve and can bridge the gap for you. So we've done that throughout the history of Insure. You know, it's easy.
It sounds easy.
Sounds easy, yes. If you don't have someone that really understands that and that's gone through that, has the industry expertise, is essential in fintech. I couldn't agree more.
You'd mentioned your time at Zeek really is what opened your eyes to the fraud that was really out there. What was that moment when you realized that building out a fraud platform could be its own business, and then the decision to say, yes, we're going to start Insure.ai?
Yeah, that's an easy one, actually. No, honestly, it's an easy one because at first we started the investment because we had no other choice. What we found out is that if we're using heuristics and the tools available at the time, we find ourselves declining, I want to say at least 20% of the transactions for fraud screening. Then you have the network that helps you a little bit further and declines 15%. So you end up declining, you know, in total more than 30% of your population. Then you count how many you decline that are new shoppers, and you get a staggering number that is somewhere between 45 and 50%. And when we did the math on our customer acquisition cost versus lifetime value, we said if we have a 50% decline, and again, the 50% is of people that have already provided you the payment instrument, right? They said, I want to purchase. Here's my credit card information. They've done the whole thing. They've gone through the entire funnel. And 50% of these people you're saying no to, and you do the CAC to LTV, the customer acquisition cost to lifetime value calculation, you see that you're never going to be profitable. So we said, okay, we cannot afford this, you know, this situation, we cannot afford it. We have to find a way to approve more clients. And once we realized that, we started building our own tools. And because we said, yes, it's possible to do that, realize that within these 20% of the people that we decline on the fraud reasons, maybe 2% are fraud. Everybody else is legitimate. And towards the middle of 17, we started seeing that what we're able to do is an order of magnitude better. Meaning we were declining roughly 2% and the rest of the world was declining somewhere between 15 and 20. And when we saw that we were really declining 2% while the best tools out there at the time we used Forta and Riskified that were very, very strong in e-commerce, they still are. They're doing an amazing job for e-commerce, but they were declining 15 to 20% on our side. And at that point, when we saw that, and we saw that Forta and Riskified at the time were raising, I want to say $50, $60 million already, both of them, we said, okay, we have something here.
How do you describe Insure AI's overarching mission for the marketplace?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it's very simple, right? So in e-commerce today, if you want to allow them to sell their goods, just like any other merchants on the e-commerce side, you want them to be able to approve 98-99% of their transactions. Simple. That's it. That's our mission. And therefore, what we set out to do has nothing to do with fraud, really. It has only to do with improving their business, with getting them more of the legitimate shoppers that are actually there to buy their product and they're declining them for no good reason. That's it.
Oh, love it. Love it. I mean, that's one of the big things is that I've had a previous guest on that is working on when you're in a subscription model and you go to rebill and you get a decline. How do you recover those declines? Because there are so many different codes that go with those declines. And so he's built using a similar, and I'm overgeneralizing here, but has leveraged machine learning and data analytics to determine when to try, how to try, if the issuer is going to do it, based upon all these different things in order to increase the approval ratio on those subscription-based services. When we start looking at subscription-based services, those are some of the first things when the economy starts to slow down that people cancel. I doubt you have a crystal ball or a hot tub time machine, which is my favorite. Tell me, what do you see as the opportunities ahead for digital goods retailers as we continue to see a little bit more pressure on the economy? What are some of the opportunities for them to get those additional approvals for those real customers?
It's easier to keep a customer than to regain a new one, right? It's very simple. So looking at your funnel and being able to optimize that, I think is the key. And we're right there to help do that. It's true for physical goods. It's true for digital goods. It's true for everyone. On the digital side, I know it's probably not very popular to say, right? I truly believe that crypto and Web3, not necessarily the way it has been going so far, but this virtual world is going to create an amazing, amazing opportunity for companies. I think that the opportunity for digital assets and digital goods in this domain are going to be enormous. There's lots of fluff and lots of hot air. Let's call it that, right?
Not only that, but you also have a ton of FUD or fear, uncertainty, and doubt going on. Yeah. So you've got the hot air and you've got the uncertainty and doubt going. And it's just like, it's right now it's colliding with all of these different things.
Yes, I agree. But on the other hand, you're starting to see some really robust business models coming out of it. And you're starting to see that there's something in there. So I believe... Me personally, I believe that, and the payment industry as well, right? There's no real good payment infrastructure in that domain today. And unless that infrastructure is allowing people to come in using fiat, right, using, standard money, not only crypto, it won't go mass market, or at least it'll take, a decade or more to go mass market. I think everybody understands that too. So you have to figure out how to overlay a payment infrastructure into that domain. We're helping a few companies do that today. We're helping companies that are creating the payment processors of the future for that to happen, because the fraud in this industry is enormous, right? It's very attractive, right? Buying crypto with a credit card, with a stolen credit card, is extremely attractive for fraudsters. Buying an NFT with a stolen credit card is very attractive because, unlike anything else, once you get the crypto, it's yours. There are no reverses, and it's very, very, very lucrative for the fraudsters to do that. So we've seen a lot of companies that are in that domain struggle, and because they don't understand fiat at all, they understand the crypto side, they don't really understand the fiat side, and we found a few that we can really help on.
So before we dive into the details, because I've got a bunch of questions around how you guys are helping with that, but what do you see the future of fintech building better fraud services using the data, but not losing consumer privacy?
In e-commerce, the king in fraud prevention is identity verification. And the common sense is very simple. If you identify the person behind the payment instrument, behind the transaction, to be the rightful owner of the payment instrument, you're safe. It's the rightful owner conducting the transaction. Everything's good. What happens in the digital world today is that there are multiple identities and they don't correlate to the e-commerce world. So if you're playing on Steam and you're buying, NFTs on OpenSea and crypto on Binance, and you're buying on Amazon, you're probably using three different email accounts for that. Most people do, right? You have a completely different avatar on Steam, right? So if you're an e-commerce platform and you're using the fact that identity verification is extremely important, you're seeing a person on Steam or on Binance using an email address that you've never seen before, and he declines that transaction for no good reason, absolutely. And the reason is he believes that identity verification and everything he knows about the environment is true for everything. It's simply not. And that ties back into that privacy issue that you've just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. So what do we need to do? So we identify behavior anomalies and can identify fraudulent behavior not necessarily a fraudulent email address or an IP address or a mismatch between them. And when you think about that, these digital assets, privacy and security are key, right? It's privacy and anonymity. We ask our merchants to stop all the friction, stop email verification, stop phone verification. Don't go through KYC unless the regulation requires it, because KYC, by the way, is a great tool for anti-money laundering. It has nothing to do with fraud prevention, nothing. So don't do that unless you
need. We'll dive into that in a little bit about so the KYC piece of it. Big piece that I got out of that was that identifying the individual using that detailed data is not as beneficial as what we once thought. And exactly. Realistically, in order to provide the privacy that people are looking for, we have to look at the behavior and the anomalies within the behavior and less about the detail within the data of the individual. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, you should. We should switch places. Yes, you did a much
better job.
Yes.
No, yeah. I have the benefit of listening and then synthesizing and then sending it back to you. Right, just talked about something that's very important: removing friction from the experience. And when we look at the fintech ecosystem and heck, just the digital ecosystem in general, it's severely disjointed. It's disconnected from really how people use the systems that they're on. What other opportunities for fintechs like Insure.ai are there to drive better customer experiences?
So I think anything that helps in conducting things behind the scenes without interacting with the consumer, looking at what they're doing and gathering data from whatever the internet has to offer, which is a lot today, obviously. Doing that without interacting with the consumer is key. Whether it's for fraud prevention, whether it's for deciding what kind of ad to display, whatever it is, doing that as seamlessly as possible, that's what's going to be the key, I believe. And we pride ourselves in adding zero friction, which is extremely important in my opinion.
The most common cause of bad customer experience isn't that high tech. It's embarrassingly simple. Yep, it's answering questions. In e-commerce, it's really easy to get bogged down with common questions. Whether that's, where's my package? How do I return or exchange this item? Or just to cancel a subscription? SolvePath is an AI-driven customer support system that enhances the customer experience with visual formats and self-serve technology to empower your customers to handle their own support requests. Get the best customer support system for your business. Get SolvePath. Get started by visiting getsolvepath.com. So how is Insure.ai positioned to lead the market in fraud prevention, and how do you see working with your partners and customers to deliver these frictionless experiences?
First, understanding that you need to look at behavior and gathering vast amounts of that. We look at everything, right? We look with the merchants we work with. We look at every mouse gesture. We look at every keystroke. We look not only around the transaction, but from the beginning of history, right? The first time you come into the website, we'll look at everything you're doing. It sounds a bit scary, but don't worry. Completely GDPR compliant, CCPA compliant, whatever. We're not sharing that with anyone. We're not using it, right? We're not using it for anything else except for approving or declining transactions. Very simple. Identifying fraudsters. So you have to look at all of that vast data lake. And use machine learning, because there's nothing else, right? There's nothing else that is capable of looking at that data lake and making and ascertaining the patterns and identifying the patterns that emerge. It's impossible to do that with rules or with, you know, whatever we used to do that, you know, 10 years ago. It's simply not possible. There's too much of it.
Rules-based stuff just, it had its day in the limelight, yeah. But now there's just so much data and the ability to create models based on rules and overrides and all these different things.
It doesn't work.
It's nearly humanly impossible with the level of data.
Yeah.
It is possible, but it's a lot easier to use these machine learning models.
It's not only that. The issue is that the fraudsters are, you know, they're ahead of that, right? So they're using machines as well. If you're using rules, they'll circumvent that in a minute. I can tell you that from one of the things that we used to do at the start of the company is we identify a fraud pattern that the models are still not very adept to dealing with. We used to create a rule that says, okay, so let's find a rule that would flag that traffic for a while until we train the model, we add the feature, we do whatever needs to happen. And what we figured out is that if you put in a rule, a strict rule, a very simple rule, it takes seconds. Seconds is an exaggeration. It takes minutes, and the fraudsters go a different way. And once they do that, you lose the pattern. You lose the attack, and they keep on hacking you until you figure out the new pattern. So don't put in rules. Find a way to adapt your model to that attack. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself just missing the attack completely. It's not only that rule-based are becoming too complicated because there's too much data, too many rules. The people cannot, you add a rule, you remove a rule, there's a conflict, you don't even know about that, etc. It's not only that. It's the fact that when you do that, the fraudsters are advanced in a way that they'll circumvent that in minutes from our perspective, you know, from our experience. So it just fails miserably.
Mentioned, you know, them making these adjustments. And one of the things that we haven't talked about is digital fraud. One of the things we haven't talked about is the digital fraud and all of the collateral damage that most people don't think about. How does digital fraud impact a business's bottom line beyond just declining the transactions?
So if you look at the total cost of fraud, it's the false negatives, what we call false negatives, meaning you have missed the fraudsters, right? So you allow a fraudster to come in, and then you find yourself out of pocket, right? So there's a chargeback, it arrives, you pay for it, you lost the merchandise, you lost the money. That's very easy to understand, right? You sold a game for $50 on Xbox, and a chargeback arrives, you lost the $50. That's it, and you're out of pocket. Number two really is all of that, you know, the declines, right? Is the legitimate customers that you decline for no reason, right? That's normally, as we've mentioned, it could be up to 20-25%. And if you look at what happens throughout the network, including what the networks decline, Visa, MasterCard, and all of these, so if you think if you could plug in a system that would increase your top line by 8% overnight, it's staggering what it could do for a business. So that's the second piece. The third piece is what you pay for the tools and people that you put in place in order to fight the fraud. Right? Eventually, it's the consumers that pay for it.
I think there's a fourth item, actually. The fourth item for me is the consumer confidence in the company that is delivering the goods. So if I'm getting declined and I'm like, I know my card's good, I know I'm a real person, and I just tried to buy this digital good or I tried to buy something else, I may just go, you know what? It's not worth it. I'll just go over to XYZ company. Exactly. Now they've just lost that customer for good.
Exactly. You lose them completely. You lose the lifetime value of all the new shoppers you decline. It's simple. From our data, 67%, like 2/3 of the people you decline on the first transaction never come back. 67%.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah,
that's what we see.
How much revenue do businesses lose on average each month by declining? And we're just talking about declining. We're not even talking about the lost customers, but declining legitimate transactions. What is the average that we start to see around this?
It varies. It varies significantly by industry, by vertical. Crypto is very, very different. So we don't understand. We don't know e-commerce, right? We don't have e-commerce clients, so I can't speak to that. Not from my own data. But I can tell you that in crypto, I'll speak percentages and not, you know, and not dollar numbers.
Percentages is perfectly fine.
Yeah. So if you look at crypto, crypto loses today on everything, on fraud prevention, on the network, on KYC, in friction, all of that, 55 to 60% of the revenue. 55 to 60% of the revenue. Insane. If you look at gaming, gaming is slightly better. Gaming is in the range of 30-35%, like half. Gift cards, it depends. If you're selling, you're selling a Visa debit card, or you find yourself in the 40s. If you're selling, restaurants or fast service businesses, etc., you'll find yourself somewhere in the range of 15-20%. But these are the ranges. There's no one that in our domain, there's no one that declines 5%. It just doesn't happen. You're declining 15-20%, or if you're in crypto, you're declining 50-60%.
Well, and digital goods are a lot different, right? Because you're the immediate delivery requires you to be a little bit more tightened up on the front end, because like we've mentioned, you don't have time.
Yeah,
to do additional research. It's either now or never is really right. What it comes into.
Right, but it's more than that, actually. So sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
It's more than that. It's the issue is that it attracts the fraudsters that do this as a business. There are in general in this world of payment fraud, there are two types of fraudsters. There are the guys that do the one-offs, right? They want to go to New York and not pay for the ticket, right? They want to get their hands on a pair of Nike sneakers they believe are going to be worth, I don't know, much more later or whatever, right? So they do a one-off transaction. And this is prevalent in e-commerce. You see that a lot. There are those that do this as a business. And these people, they go on the dark web, they buy a list of stolen financial instruments. They buy a list of stolen Visa cards or PayPal accounts or bank accounts, whatever. And now they need to turn that into more cash, right? Because they pay $10 to $50 a line. That's how much it costs today. That's the going price. So they need to make more than $10 to $50 on each line. How do you do that when you have a payment instrument? You buy things and you resell them. Now imagine the difference between buying and reselling 1,000 iPhones and buying and reselling 1,000 gift cards or 1,000 game codes for Xbox. Not the same thing at all. Hmm. Not the same thing at all. And as a result of that, the guys that do this as a business, they are much more incentivized to do this on a digital asset or a digital good service, much more. And even more than that, if you think about that, once you started using that list of stolen financials, there's a window of opportunity. It's going to get blocked, right? Someone's going to figure out it got stolen and it's going to get blocked. And if you don't get rid of all of that inventory you have within the next couple of hours, it's gone. You're not going to be able to use it. It's going to get declined everywhere. So you have to do it fast. So you have to run a machine. You have to run a machine. And that creates a pattern that is extremely different from normal e-commerce. That's the core difference.
Well, it just the speed, I think, is the biggest piece that I'm hearing, right? So if I use a fraudulent card to buy all the sizes in the Nike sneakers, and I get that the amount of time I have to fence those goods is a lot longer before somebody catches on versus getting an Xbox code. Okay. I may only have seconds or minutes
to
get rid of those before it gets caught. So you're looking at days, weeks, months versus seconds, minutes, maybe hours before that pattern gets caught. And exactly. So that is really huge. And how does risk-based authentication really protect the legitimate users while addressing this potential fraudulent activity that happens so fast?
Normally today, they just decline more. It's very simple. They just decline more. And that's what we're trying to prevent, because there's no reason to do that. There's no reason. You assume that there is, first of all, it's true. There is a bigger fraud pressure, no question, but it's not as big as you think. And more than that, if you do a good job, they go elsewhere and you find yourself dealing with a much smaller fraud pressure eventually. So you shouldn't assume it's cost of doing business. That's our motto.
So with you spending so much time in the crypto space, KYC or know your customer is a really, really big thing. And while it's intended to prevent payment fraud, it often has the opposite effect due to, you know, lacking universal standards and a whole bunch of other things. And I recently read that in Q2 of this year, that it's estimated that between 60 and 80% of all the reported fraud came from users that actually passed KYC protocols. Now, to be super clear, that is in the fiat to crypto on-ramping. That's where I found those numbers and I looked at that. What are some of the ways that fraudsters are able to bypass these KYC protocols and gain access to these approved accounts?
Yeah. So first of all, KYC was not originally meant for payment fraud. It's being used today for payment fraud. It was originally meant for anti-money laundering, right? It was all about making sure that people cannot launder money using these digital aspects of the fintech world. And it is today used by companies to try and prevent payment fraud because they still believe that identity verification is the right thing to do. And KYC obviously is the biggest hammer in their toolbox mm-hmm. when it comes to identity verification. However, if you look, if you go back to the dark web, right? If you go to the dark web today, and I can share with you a little bit, a few screen captures of what because we crawl the dark web to identify, what's going on. You can buy a Binance account today for less than $100, a KYC Binance account for less than $100. You can buy a Revolut account for $120. Some of the lower, some of the smaller exchanges, not more than $50. And the reason for that is, if you think about, the days where KYC was a physical thing, right? You had to come to the bank with your passport, right? Or an ID card, depending on the country. And the guy there would scan it, would compare it to the governmental records that he has somewhere. And right, imagine what you would need to do in order to create a KYC verified account that is to be sold for fraud. You have to really go into the bank and do that. You're not going to be successful 100% of the time. You're going to be successful partial. If you get caught, it's not a great situation.
Not a good thing to get caught for.
Now think about it in the digital world. Right, so there are operations today that find people, and they would pay them $20 for a KYC verified account on Binance, because they know they can sell it for $50 immediately, and they would activate these people, and they would activate thousands of people, they would get hundreds of accounts, and they would make tens of thousands of dollars that day, and that's what happens today. There are operations that activate people from third world countries. For them, $20 is a lot. If they can do $20 every day for someone else, they don't need to do anything else. They'll be happy to do that. And they don't care about, the fact that someone's going to steal something from Binance in the Western world. That's the last thing they care about. And that's what you see happening now. And the dark web is full of these accounts, all for sale.
So how does technology really need to be used in order to fight against this KYC fraud?
So there are two things. One, don't rely on KYC. Don't assume that if an account has gone through KYC, there's no fraud. Don't assume that. Yeah, you can use that as part of your data, right? It's, obviously in crypto, I don't think that there's anyone that's trying to use rule-based. So you have a machine, that's okay. Give that information to the machine as a feature, but be aware that that does not mean that the account is foolproof. Don't use it as a rule. That's number one. And number two, find other ways. And what we've done, I can tell you that today we're not using we're using KYC data. We're not using whether it was verified or not, because we found that the KYC data is interesting to look at, but whether you've gone through it or not, we disregard that because it skews our decisions. So we stop that. And we're using the behavior analytics that I just mentioned. And I'll give you an example. So you remember we said the guys need to go fast, right? They need mm-hmm. to work with their, you know, with their credit card. They have 1,000 credit cards now. They need to get rid of them in an hour, and they have to create an attack. And it creates something that looks, the pattern looks very similar to DDoS, right? Distributed denial of service. It's like a wave of seemingly legitimate individuals. They're coming. They're not trying, by the way, to crash your servers. The only thing they're trying to do is to buy as much as they can. That's it. So how can you identify that there's such a pattern? And they're coming from different IP addresses, using different payment instruments. They're doing a good job. So I'll give you an example of something that we found out that works. So let's assume you're looking at how long a person takes before they decide whether they purchase a Bitcoin or an Ether. Let's assume you're looking at that. And you've identified a consumer coming in, and it takes 12.3 seconds to make that decision. Okay, now, there's nothing you can do about it. The second person comes in a second later, and he hesitates for 12.3 seconds as well on that same decision. That's interesting. The fifth or sixth person, you're going to say, okay, I get it. They look coming from different places, but they're actually coming there. It's a ring. It's an orchestrated attack, and you can stop it at that point. But to identify that, you have to look at hundreds of thousands of such features and identify the patterns that emerge in real time so that you can identify the pattern fast enough and block it before it becomes too devastating. So you cannot stop all the fraud, right? So the first 3, 4, 5 transactions, they will go through, but you will stop the rest of it. And then he'll need to regroup and do something different. And then again, you'll catch him after 4 or 5 transactions, et cetera, et cetera. So Alex, just as an example. Yeah, just as an example.
Yeah. Alex, you and I talked about this earlier. Like, I'm a huge data geek, so I love trying to figure out like the way data can be used and different data lake models and different machine learning models and just kind of all that anomaly detection. Yeah. I get excited about it when I start to learn more about it. So we could talk about this for days.
Yeah.
But what do you hope that the audience of FinTech Confidential will walk away with after watching or listening this episode?
Number one is, don't treat fraud as cost of doing business. It doesn't have to be. Number two is, if you are in this digital assets or digital good domain, make sure that what you're doing is adapted to your domain and is not trying to be copied from e-commerce, etc. It doesn't work. It's not the same thing. Number three is what we've discussed. Don't try to build rules. Don't try to build rules. You have to use, it's a machine learning game. There's no point in trying to do anything else. No point. That's it.
Oh, well, last question that may cause a little bit of thought for you. If you were to give fintech founders just one piece of advice to build a successful company, what would that be?
So, you know, that's a piece that we have spoken about before. But so my first advice would be, don't do it. But the second one, once you've decided, if that's something you really want to do, I would say be careful on when you decide you want to start to scale. Because in fintech, margins are thin, right? It's difficult to deliver because the competition is so fierce. The market is so, you know, educated, right? You're talking to people who understand what they're doing there. And as a result, you have to deliver the value in the right way. Don't make the assumption that if you have, you know, 3, 4 clients that are paying you tens of thousands of dollars, you've figured out product market fit, you have a good salespeople, you're going to ramp it up to 50 and you're going to be doing 100 times more next year. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You have to figure out the model really well. You have to assume that acquiring the customers is going to be more expensive later and not cheaper. A lot of people believe that customer acquisition goes down. It doesn't. It goes up. Plan for it. Don't start scaling before you really have it nailed down. Because if you do that, you end up nowhere. We see a lot of fintech companies that have a great idea. They prove it can work. They get a product market fit. People are willing to pay for it. And then they start scaling. They scale too fast and they fall on their face. And then no one's really willing to back them up again. And it's a lot of companies lose because of that.
That's fantastic advice. Alex, thank you for taking so much time out of your evening there in Israel. As we've talked, Tel Aviv is one of my favorite places to be. I'm honestly jealous of the fact that you're there and I'm here in Arizona. But thank you for joining. What I'm going to do is in the show notes and in the descriptions, I'm going to go ahead and put all the links on how to get a hold of Insure.ai, how to get a hold of Alex. If you want to learn things about it, some tools and some resources that they provide, I'm going to go ahead and put that in the description so you guys can click on it and go straight to it. Alex, any closing words before we call it a day?
I think it's always a pleasure, and I enjoy speaking about our product, obviously. I'm passionate about it, as you can see. I'm passionate about the industry, so it's always a pleasure. Really, thank you for giving me the chance to speak.
Alex, thanks again, and I really appreciate it. Support provided by SolvePath in e-commerce. It's really easy to get bogged down with basic support inquiries. Whether that's where is my package, how do I return or exchange this item, or just to cancel a subscription. SolvePath is an AI-driven customer support system that uses a visual format and self-serve technology to quickly and effectively resolve issues, resulting in satisfying support experiences for customers. Customize a visual support experience for your e-commerce brands and increase your overall performance, enhance the customer experience, and drastically reduce support costs. Get the best customer support system for your business. Get SolvePath. Get started by visiting getsolvepath.com.
This has been a production of Diamond D3 Media, with all rights reserved. This is provided for informational purposes only. It is not offered or intended to be used as legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. We strive to provide accurate and up-to-date information, but will not be responsible for any missing facts or inaccurate information. You comply and understand that you should use any of this information at your own risk. Cryptocurrencies are highly volatile financial assets, so research and make your own financial decisions.